safety nets are the only way for poor people to deal with this shock. It's a shock that's unlike any other because it comes from a political decision to lock down. So there's no question that there's a responsibility for governments to help poor people at this moment.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Now that COVID-19 has reached low and middle income countries, the measures to contain it are likely to have an immediate negative impact on millions of households. Is it possible for a low income country to piece together a coherent and comprehensive social protection strategy? Well, that's the challenge taken up by a paper called Social Protection Response to the COVID-19 Crisis, Options for Developing Countries. It's just published by Francois Gérard of Queen Mary University of London, Clément Humbert of Warwick University, and Kate Orkin from Oxford. Clément and Kate join me today. Clément, welcome.
Hi, Tim.
And Kate, hello.
Thanks for having us.
Clément, in your paper, you set out the details of what you call a broad safety net. But given the scale of this challenge, how effective do you think it's possible for these safety nets to be in the immediate future?
I think I'd like to start by emphasizing that the shock that households in developing countries are facing right now is a very big shock and an unusual one. So on the scale of the shock, the NGO BRAC has just released findings from a national representative service from Bangladesh. It suggests that the household income is down by 70%, employment is down by 60%, and as households have very little savings, consumption is down by 20 to 30%. So that's a very large, significant shock. Households in developing countries face bad economic shocks all the time, but the strategies they usually employ to deal with them, they're not available in the current situation. So they cannot do more work, they cannot migrate to urban areas, they can ask their friends and relatives to help, but unfortunately, all their friends and all their relatives, including people who have migrated abroad, they're all equally affected. So basically, safety nets are the only way for poor people to deal with this shock. It's a shock that's unlike any other because it comes from a political decision to lock down. So there's no question that there's a responsibility for governments to help poor people at this moment.
Looking at that at a national level for a moment, finding the money to provide this safety net is a problem because borrowing was always difficult, but it's become even more difficult for low-income countries, hasn't it?
Yeah, so really developing countries face not only a public health, but the public finance crisis. Tax revenues are down because trade is down, mineral prices are down, and of course the economic activity is down. So there's less resources for government. And then there's all these very urgent needs for spending, one being of course health and the other is safety nets, what we're talking about today. I should say there were very high expectations for the G20 meeting for joint interventions with the IMF, the World Bank, and people had expected all sorts of big Marshall plans for the world, debt cancellation, global solidarity fund for some, but instead it's been postponing repayments. The crisis might have been delayed slightly or alleviated slightly, but it's very much there. And it's a very big problem. It really looks like more of a global response is needed still.
So we have to fall back on what individual countries can do. You identify three parts to this. First, we're looking at social insurance, and that's tough to provide, isn't it? Because in low-income countries, most workers aren't covered by it. Why is that? What can we do about that in the short run?
So the first part is why. Well, a larger share of workers are in employment categories that are really difficult to insure against risk. So many work for informal unregistered businesses, which don't contribute to social insurance programs. Others work for formal businesses, but they aren't in formal contracts. So the businesses are formal, but the workers aren't covered. And then the self-employed account for a much larger share of employment in developing countries. And then also the government programs are more limited in developing countries, even for formal employees. So the share of developing countries in which workers are eligible for some form of employment insurance is much lower than in high-income countries. So what can we do in that context? There's a lot that can be done, especially in lower middle income countries who often have more developed schemes. One of the biggest solutions has been job retention schemes. Here, the government subsidizes firms so that they can pay workers even if they aren't working. That avoids destroying existing jobs, which should be viable again. And the idea behind this is that workers have firm-specific human capital. They're more productive at their existing firm than if they get laid off and they have to find another job later. And so it prevents prevents the economy from losing these gains in productivity. So Brazil, South Africa, Morocco, Thailand have done versions of this. It's a very good idea. It's hard to do. So the South African experience has been tough. Many firms don't trust that they're going to get reimbursed, or the government has just been slow in enrolling people in the scheme. So many firms have put people on unpaid leave and laid off some. So they allocated $3 billion to this scheme. They've only managed to pay out 1/30th of that in the first 2 weeks. But still, progress has been made, and it's a very laudable aim to try and do these programs. Other things that governments can do that are easier to administer, just giving firms tax relief or delaying their tax payments, especially for small firms. Kenya and South Africa have both done that. And then in the unfortunate instance where workers do have to be let go, there are also a number of things that governments can require. So Francois Gerard and Johanna Naratomi have written about mandatory severance pay. So governments could consider topping that up, spreading its payment over time to avoid workers spending it too quickly. They could adjust eligibility rules for unemployment insurance. They can let workers access their retirement fund. And then the final sort of area is really to think about not formal workers, but those who are self-employed. We've seen in the rest of the world that this is really difficult to do. It's hard to determine people's usual earnings. It's hard to determine how much in earnings they've lost because of the crisis. Those challenges are worse in developing countries. So there have been creative solutions that governments have put in place, particularly in Brazil. They've made unconditional monthly transfers of a fixed amount, or they've given emergency low interest credit lines for unemployed workers.
But as you say, Kate, social insurance doesn't reach a large proportion of the population. So we have to turn to a social assistance at this national level to reach more people. What sort of assistance should we be giving? Who should we give it to?
I think social assistance really is the part where developing countries have a lot of weapons they can use. While putting together numbers for this piece, we found numbers from the World Bank suggesting, for example, that up to 80% of households in South Asia might be covered by one social assistance program or another. And there's really a variety of them. So you might have cash transfers, in-kind transfers, it might be just food provision, and it might be public works. And those programs have been thought to alleviate poverty. But in the face of this crisis, those programs are very much useful. For example, in-kind transfers are very useful when the supply chains might have broken down, when there's food shortages, as in urban India right now. So the public distribution system that India has developed within rural and urban areas, targeted at households below the poverty line, this has been like one of the main pillar of India's response to the crisis by simply increasing the rations available to households. There's a whole debate of in-kind versus cash. So cash transfers are quicker, of course. They're also more fungible, so beneficiaries can decide what they do with it. So a good example of that in the context of the COVID crisis has been Indonesia, which has increased both the amounts and the frequency of its main flagship cash transfer program, PKHAM. I should say there are some other types of social assistance programs that are not really social distancing compatible. So that's the case of public works, where beneficiaries are asked to work. But here again, Ethiopia decided to use its program to pay people in advance, meaning without asking them to work, and even to extend assistance to others. While good developing countries might not have a lot of leverage out of social insurance, if you put together all these social assistance programs, and each program, of course, has its own eligibility base, you know, social pension for elderly, child grant in South Africa. So the idea is that you use all of them simultaneously, while still keeping in mind that this might not be enough, because these programs are targeted at helping people who need help in normal times, and these are not normal times.
Even though you can reach more people with social assistance, as you say, we're still faced with potentially having to enroll millions of people in any program that exists and having to do that very quickly. Is it possible to do that?
So yes, it is possible. So to clarify really what's needed to enroll new beneficiaries, well, you need a way to identify them and you need a way to pay them. And in some cases, both of them are just easy. So one example is many governments might have open bank accounts for all to promote financial inclusion, the case in Chile and in India. And so that means governments have the bank account details of the poor in the country, so they can just decide to transfer cash to those accounts. One example of this situation is Peru, where they have this very important and generous conditional cash transfer. And to target it, to identify the beneficiaries for that cash transfer, they've done a census of the population and assessed each household's wealth and economic status. And so what they can do is now provide more assistance to people who were, even back then, they were poor, but also extend assistance to people who might have been just rich enough not to receive assistance, but now assistance can be extended to them. So that's easy from the point of view of identification. Now, from the point of view of paying them, it's a bit of a challenge. So what the Peruvian government has done is to make the money available to them in a national bank, but they still need to come and collect. And so there's been crowding of bank branches, and which is, of course, a problem. Either way, governments need to open their program also to new beneficiaries. And I think one of the most remarkable example of that, most ambitious example of that, has been Pakistan, which is planning to do a giant expansion of their social assistance program, ESAS, to at least 10 million new families. So that's almost tripling the number of beneficiaries. So how do you do this? Well, the government has done an information campaign. They said this program is there to help you in this time of crisis. And text us with your national ID number, and we'll make that assistance available to you. So it's possible, although, of course, in many contexts, it's challenging.
Because it is so challenging, you interestingly point out that there is also a role for local government and NGOs. We tend naturally to think about such huge programs as being very top-down and requiring national governments. Where can local governments and NGOs contribute to this?
So it's first important just to think about what's there. So state and municipal governments in developing countries, they have an increasing range of responsibilities. Many countries have devolved a range of government functions down to the lower echelons of government, including some responsibilities for social insurance. So NREGA, India's employment guarantee scheme, is one example of really extreme decentralization right down to local government level for this program. Developing countries also often have a large cadre of local leaders at a very low level. So in Kenya, for example, each village of 120 to 200 households has a volunteer village leader who reports up to the lowest level of paid civil servants. Governments also have networks of employees in very rural areas often, so teachers, but also community health workers, agricultural extension officers that are in contact with more remote communities and have in the past supported them in accessing services. And then we actually also talked, as well as NGOs, about private associations that are formed by groups of developing country citizens, so self-help groups, rotating savings and credit associations. It may be unusual to involve these kinds of actors directly in provision of state assistance, but we're really in unprecedented times. And these can have very wide coverage of very hard to reach populations. In Ethiopia, for example, in very remote villages, two areas where we work, over 90% of villages are in Idia, so local burial associations, and those are very hard people to reach in other ways. So how can these types of actors help in delivery of COVID assistance? The first way is encouraging beneficiaries to sign up for programs if they don't have information about them. So South Africa had a network of early childhood community caregivers who government used to help families in enrolling for child support grants pre-crisis. They could be used similarly in these situations. In terms of non-state actors, India used savings and loan associations to help enroll participants in health insurance schemes. This was even before the crisis. And India has used national rural livelihood missions and self-help groups to try and get people into sanitation programs. So encouraging beneficiaries to sign up for programs is a really important function. It's possible that these actors have funding or staff already in place at local level that can react quickly. So many local authorities under decentralization often receive block grant funding to address locally identified needs, and they have structures in place to monitor how it's allocated. So this could be temporarily repurposed. For example, the Indian government has allowed state governments to use disaster funds to provide shelter and food to migrant workers who are a really hard population to reach. And then finally, these structures could in some cases channel support. There are some populations that it'll be really hard to reach. Only 69% of adults in the world have any kind of digital bank or mobile money account. So you can use structures to get money out to unbanked people. India's relief package encourages building and construction worker welfare funds to provide emergency assistance. And communities are giving to each other as well. So at local level, there's also going to be other charitable giving going on that government can try to encourage. One example has been zakat funds in Muslim communities before Ramadan have been a real source of response to the crisis.
Now, you also point out that local infrastructure can be a really valuable source of bottom-up information at the moment on local economic conditions, or maybe who needs help the most so that it can be targeted better. It's important to recognise that as well.
Hans Rosling, when he spoke about the response to the Ebola crisis, he said it was beaten by the Ugandan public health team in an Excel spreadsheet. And the point of that was we think of these as being government getting things to people, but the flow of information is really going to determine how successful the response is. So there are two different ways. The first you mentioned already, so local structures can be involved in identifying individuals in dire need of additional support. As we're putting together this patchwork of different solutions, there are going to be important exclusion errors. And already local structures have often been involved in targeting social assistance programs pre-crisis, both in gathering information on which populations are vulnerable and in trying to prioritize assistance. So Rwanda, for example, is using local structures currently to target in-kind food packages, which are going to be given out to complement its existing social protection schemes. In Ethiopia is another example, use local feedback to identify individuals. And then the other is just to channel up broader ranges of information up to decision-making structures, which is really important when travel is limited and there are parts of the country that aren't well covered by cell phone signal. That information can be about movements of people, about prices and availability of food, and then, of course, about where the programs are going out well and which groups remain uncovered. And in many food insecure countries, so Malawi, Ethiopia, there is actually quite good infrastructure already to collect local data on food security. And they use this already to channel food or cash to famine-affected areas when there's food insecurity. And they've actually already used this sort of information to target public works programs. Obviously, not all countries have that, but some of the most vulnerable do have it already. And that information function is going to be vital.
During non-pandemic times, we worry a lot about accountability in the provision of a safety net, the dangers of fraud and corruption. Is it time to stop worrying about this for a few months and just get on with what we have to do?
In normal times, every social program has instances of clientelism, of especially we've been talking about decentralization, so local leaders deciding who gets the assistance and who doesn't. So in every program, there's also what's often called leakages, so money that doesn't reach intended beneficiaries but ends up in the pockets of somebody else. Of course, these instances make for interesting research, also juicy headlines in newspapers. I should say that also, you know, whenever it's systematically checked, on the whole, social programs mostly reach intended beneficiaries. So India's employment guarantee, NREGA, ever since it was created, the debate was how much of this money is being lost. And it might have been 30%, might have been 20%, might have been 10%. But then if you look at what it did to lift people out of poverty, it's mostly done the job. So of course, in this time of crisis, what's important is that we should keep in mind the solutions that have been developed to ensure that it's 10, 20% and not 80% of the money that's being lost. So whenever possible, of course, the best practices should be followed. Biometric ID when possible, make the system transparent, and that's very much possible with e-governance. Also, whenever you're thinking about whether you want to launch a completely new, different social assistance program, or rather give more money to a program that already exists, well, the program that already exists probably has been vetted and checked all these checks and balances and all these things that ensure that the amount of leakages is actually down to a reasonable level, as opposed to a new program that would take some time to figure out and might lead to more loss of public money. Should also say that involving local communities, that's another way to promote accountability. So accountability also is not all checking from up to down, it's also bottom up.
We normally would spend a lot of effort in conditionality, thinking about targeting effectively so that we reach only the right people, the people that we want to reach. But I suppose this can also involve a delay in delivering that help. At the moment, do the benefits of acting fast outweigh the disadvantages if some of the help is misdirected?
We would argue yes. I think emergency fast cash is actually a really smart investment in long-term poverty alleviation at the moment. So, you know, there are moral arguments, there are human rights arguments, but the cost benefit is also very much in favor of getting cash out. Stefan Dirk, on the ex-chief economist at DFID, has called cash to the poor a no regrets policy. He says it's one of the things that countries can do that they are sure they won't regret later. So two big reasons for that. Poor households often take short-term decisions when they're facing a shock that leave them in deeper long-term poverty. We fear that households reduce children's nutritional intake. We know stunted children have lower schooling attainment. They have lower earnings throughout their lives. There is evidence women may enter into transactional sexual relationship. During the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, Imran Rasool and others found that young women had older partners, higher rates of pregnancy. They didn't go back to school. And so getting social assistance out can mitigate some of those decisions. The other is that households dissave. So they sell productive assets like cars or vehicles or phones, or they dip into their meager savings and they usually use those to look for work. And so if you're losing the means of earning, that can lead to many additional years of poverty. And we know that cash grants can help avoiding that households sell assets when they face shocks. There's a strong case for getting the money out. There are also some things we know already from existing social programs that suggest that the mistargeting isn't as much of a problem as we might think. So firstly, you know, even if you're using social programs that are not built for purpose, the targeting at the poor can actually be quite good. So the University of Cape Town in South Africa found that using the child support grant to try and reach informal workers, if you looked at the poorest half of the population, the child support grant actually reached 80% of individuals who were in households with informal workers who weren't covered by the unemployment insurance schemes. So actually the child support grant was a really good way to reach a whole other population. And they were able to see that because they had a nationally representative survey. And then we also know that assistance can be shared beyond the beneficiaries. So we've seen from other social programs, South African pensions received by grandparents benefit grandchildren, they benefit young adults in the household. We know from Progresa in Mexico that households who are not eligible for it still got loans and gifts from eligible households in the same village, and they have higher food consumption. And so one idea is to, you know, send money out where you can and actually get government to acknowledge explicitly that they're not reaching everybody and encourage people to share their resources with others who they know are in need.
It's very interesting and encouraging to hear about some of the action that's already being taken. Clément, Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
The paper, it's a short one, but as you can hear, it's packed with ideas and references. Is social protection response to the COVID-19 crisis, options for developing countries. The authors are François Gérard, Clément Humbert, and Kate Orkin. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform and you'll never miss an episode. Or you can find past episodes at voxdev.org.